Members, good afternoon. We're going to get started. My apologies for gaveling us in later. I just wanted to make sure that our visuals were working, but as usual, we have excellent staff here in the House who got us all hooked up appropriately. There is a quorum here today. And members, just a couple things very quickly. The chair will be issuing rules for the committee soon. We're still in the process of drafting that up. And again, Representative Johnson, Chair Johnson, our intent is to show you those before we distribute those. And then also, following up on something that Chair Johnson raised yesterday about the room, I have put in a request to get us to a different room. So let's see how that goes. But you know this place, you know, probably is going to require, you know, a steady stream of pressure. So with that, I would like us to take our first formal action as a committee, which would be the approval of the minutes. And so I'm wondering, Representative Edelson, if you can make a motion for us this afternoon.
I motion to move in the minutes.
All right. So minutes have been moved for, what was the date? January 16th. And so the minutes are before you. They're quite simple. Members, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. So with that, today we're going to have an initial conversation with the Department of Public Safety, with a special focus on the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And this gives me a terrific opportunity to welcome a longtime friend and colleague here to our committee, who will make some opening comments. And I understand, Commissioner, that you also have some pending appointments fairly soon. So feel free to stay as long as you can and to share whatever you wish to share. Commissioner John Harrington, welcome to our committee.
Representative Mariani, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is John Harrington. Some of you may know me from some of my past lives. I've had 40 years in public safety, 33 of those with the St. Paul Police Department, the last six as their chief of police. I spent 2 years here in the Minnesota Senate, representing Senate District 67, and then the last 6 years, many of you knew me through my other hat of being the Metropolitan Transit Police Chief. I am absolutely delighted to come and serve the people of the state of Minnesota again, and to serve them in this role as the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety is a much bigger place than I thought it was. I really should have looked this up before I submitted my application, because it is, I could have named five of the different divisions that are in the department before I got here, and now I can probably name all 14 of them, so I'm getting better at that. It's a big and very complex Department of State Government, as I said, with 14 divisions, but we share one common mission, and that is to keep Minnesotans safe. Whether you're from Worthington or Wayzata, whether you're from Aiken or, you know, any place in between, we are committed to the idea that we are going to keep all Minnesotans safe. There are about 2,100 Department of Public Safety employees, and we operate programs in law enforcement, emergency management, traffic safety, alcohol gambling enforcement, also known as the Fun Police, emergency communications, crime victims assistance, fire safety, pipeline safety, driver's licenses, and vehicle titles. Now, only a portion of that are reporting through this committee. Alcohol and gambling enforcement, fire marshals, the Office of Justice Programs, Emergency Communication Network, Homeland Security, and with me today, the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or the BCA. In partnership, DPS is working with local governments and with nonprofit organizations all over Minnesota. And under my watch, we are committed to a process and the principles of building our programs along evidence-based and data-driven information. We will absolutely be engaged with the community. So in community engagement is, I'm a community policing officer from my early days, and that is part of my commitment that every department in the Department of Public Safety will be engaged in community policing and will be community engaged. I believe that the first rule of law enforcement and policing comes back from Sir Robert Peel, and it says that our job is to prevent crime and disorder, not simply to enforce the law and clean up the mess afterwards. And so we believe that education and crime prevention is a fundamental tool of the department. We will work, and I've learned that I have engineers, a lot of them actually, with pipeline safety and fire engineers and arson investigators. So we will use engineering. We will use best practices to try and engineer situations so crime does not occur and disorder does not occur and where people can feel safe. And then finally, when it is necessary, we will use the enforcement tools and the regulatory tools that we have at our disposal to hold people accountable for bad behavior. I am really delighted to be here, and I'm looking forward to working with many of you I've worked with on other projects, both in this, my role as a senator, and in my role as police chief. And I'm really, really looking forward to working with each of you individually and jointly to make the Department of Public Safety the preeminent department for the state of Minnesota. With no further ado, I will turn this over to Drew Evans, the superintendent of the PCA.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And I think it'll be our goal here in the Minnesota House to make sure that your experience with the legislature will be now balanced against your experience in the Senate, and you'll see just how delightful and engaging and affirming and fun it is to hang out in the House. I think we do have a couple of questions, so I'm going to ask Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Harrington, I'm going to have to get used to saying that. I'm just wondering if Governor Waltz has given you any indications of public safety issues in your agencies that are a priority for him that you're able to share with us, with this committee at this time?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair. I unfortunately cannot give you any clear indications that what we have done for the first week as we've been working on the budget, which I think is a document that does direct some of those indications. And the things that we've talked about in our budgetary process has been things along trying to make sure that deficiencies are taken care of, things along Homeland Security, making sure that we have funding, because we do recognize that with the federal shutdown there are going to be issues around FEMA dollars coming into the state. We also recognize that there may be issues around VAWA dollars, violence against women, and our crime victim dollars coming into the state. But that has been the primary focus of our work with the governor's office thus far, and I promise you, as soon as we get a little more direction, I will be happy to come back and explicate that and let you know how we're going to operate and implement those as we move the legislative agenda along.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to that, Commissioner. Representative Grassl.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Commissioner, and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your service in law enforcement. So, do you have any specific area of focus for your division there that you can share with us?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I would say is I have a vision for public safety. In my 33 years with St. Paul Police Department, we operated out of a mission and a vision that says that the gold standard for policing was a department that was both reflective of and responsive to the community that we serve. My intention is to make sure that every division within the Department of Public Safety meets that gold standard. And so that will mean increased attention to making sure that we reflect the values of all Minnesotans, greater Minnesota, the Twin Cities, the exurbans, the suburbs, but also that our department and our division directors are first and foremost listening. You cannot be responsive if you do not hear what your constituents want you to know. And so the first duty, I believe, for any manager, any leader in these kind of organizations is to stop talking and listen so that we can know what are the needs of Minnesotans all over the state in terms of their public safety needs. So those are my broad strokes. I come from a background where victim services are very close to my heart. I have served on working on domestic violence. I've served working on issues around human trafficking. I've served working on issues around general crime victims. And so victims and those whose voices don't get heard except through the police departments will always be very, very close to my heart. And as a police officer, first responder, it is, I also believe, taking care of those first responders. And now I'm seeing that in a much broader role. How do we take care of the arson investigators who are going out and seeing the charred bodies of individuals who've died in fires? How do we take care of the folks that are taking the 911 calls and are hearing the cries of distress of the public and they feel powerless to do anything about it? How do we take care of those folks that are serving the victims who hear over and over again the atrocities that people have committed? How do we take good care of them? Because the better care we take of them, the better care they can take care of the community.
Thank you, sir.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't resist noting how excited I am about the choice of the commissioner. We had got to work with one another when he was a commander in St. Paul, and I was just a resident in the neighborhood, and then got to work together as a police chief on domestic violence issues and sex trafficking issues, Metro Transit. You should know that now Commissioner Harrington, former Chief Harrington, established training for every cadet to go through the academy with Metro Transit to make sure that every new Metro Transit officer gets training on issues of exploitation and trafficking. And to have somebody with the background of having served as chief in two different agencies and risen up through law enforcement ranks and to have served as a legislator, that's a pretty powerful combination of experiences, and then to have excelled and just done a phenomenal dedicated work all the way along. So I'm really excited the chance to work with you myself and for the committee as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well said, Representative Pinto. Words right out of my mouth. congratulations, I didn't formally say that in front of the committee, and on your appointment. I'm really struck by the commitment and the action that you've taken in my home city to have a police department that truly reflects the people who live in the city and can be trusted to be a voice, particularly for those who are often disenfranchised from our society, to have a voice. So I look forward to our work together this coming year, and members, we certainly will have plenty of opportunities to interact with Commissioner Harrington. We appreciate your offer of being open and engaging with us. Good luck to you, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you very much, one and all. I will see you very shortly, I hope.
All right. Very well. And before we move on to Superintendent Evans, and I apologize, I meant to do this earlier, and I didn't give you a heads up, Representative Miller was excused from the last meeting, so I just want to, you know, have an opportunity for you to share some words, and then Representative Howard, we missed you. You had a conflict as well, so you can have an opportunity to introduce yourself to the committee. So I want to make sure both you gentlemen have that opportunity as well. I'll start to my right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very kind of you. And I do apologize for not making yesterday. I had a previous commitment, actually, with the president of the Union Gospel Mission. I think they do wonderful work. And I basically, I'll name names. I managed to marry up the president of Union Gospel Mission, the president of the Union Gospel Mission, with former Representative Matt Dean, to do some work for them. So that was a nice little connection that we did. And I didn't want to disrupt that. That's what we did yesterday.
I was not aware that's where Representative Dean is.
No, he's not going to be working there. This wasn't a public announcement of where he's working. He's just going to be doing some volunteer work for them. So,
got it.
Right. So long story short, that's what we met about. Maybe too much information for this. But I represent District 17A, which is western Minnesota. I have counties out there, as they say, not towns. It's Swift, Chippewa, most of Renville County, and four townships in Candiwai County. So for those that are more metro, if you know where Wilmer is, I don't serve Wilmer, but I have west, southwest, and south of there. Very strong agriculture land, and I really appreciate being on this committee. I look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and the other people on this committee, and look forward to the work we get done ahead. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Chair. My name's Michael Howard, serving District 50A, and that's Richfield and East Bloomington. I'm very excited to be serving on the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. I previously served on the city council in Richfield and have such admiration for those that keep our community safe, and look forward to this community or this committee being a place where we can connect our community to the work of public safety, because of course it's so personal and vital to each and every one of us to feel safe in our community, and just so excited to get to work.
Terrific. Thank you, Representative Howard. I am struck, members, by the diversity that's reflected in this committee in terms of the geographic diversity and demographic diversity of our state. We're a big state, and I think it's sometimes easy for those of us who live in the Twin Cities urban area to think of ourselves as a big state, but you get out in the car, you start driving around, and then you see the incredible rich differences as you move from county to county. And so we're big geographically, we're also big in terms of the scope of world perspectives and cultures in our state, and you all bring that to this committee. It is so appropriate that this committee in particular is able to bring that diversity to our deliberations here. So with that, members, I'm going to welcome Mr. Drew Evans, who's superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. He's going to provide an overview of the BCA structure, duties, and initiatives. I want to think of this as a good introduction for us, so hopefully we'll be able to engage with Superintendent Evans on core questions of purpose, clarifications of what the BCA does, why it does it. I'd be interested in and you, Superintendent, sharing a little bit about how that's evolved over time. That's been my experience in learning more about our broad public safety and criminal justice community. It's just incredible leadership that this state has played, including with the BCA, and how that's evolved over time. And then also your thoughts around emerging issues, particularly emerging issues related to criminal justice reform. And why not talk about the budget if you also have the time? And if not, we could do that next time as well. So, members, we have, a little bit over a good hour. So let's settle in and let's have a good, meaningful conversation with Superintendent Evans. I would invite you, members, to ask questions at the point at which those arise, so that we're not having Superintendent Evans just do a marathon of presentation. So, Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. I am Drew Evans. I have the privilege to serve as the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I have with me today three deputy superintendents that I'll reference as well. You can all wave to the committee, so you can see them for reference. I know some of you have worked with them over the years, but we very much welcome the opportunity to talk to all of you today about the great work the men and women of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension do on behalf of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And as you've noted, we have a very large, diverse state, and we very much work to fulfill that mission wherever we are in Minnesota, working to keep Minnesotans safe. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was established in 1927, really to assist Minnesota peace officers in solving local crimes and apprehending criminals. If you rewind 80-some, 90-some years ago now, this was a time of prohibition, and we were experiencing people transiting across states, across communities, and so there was a need for additional law enforcement on a statewide basis. We became part of the Department of Public Safety in 1969 when the state merged a number of public safety entities into one division that the commissioner referenced just a little while ago, and we've been part of the Department of Public Safety since that time. Our facility that I'd invite all of you to come take a tour at some time if you have the opportunity, can get a hold of me. It's a really state-of-the-art facility that we moved into in 2003, and it remains state-of-the-art because you've invested in the work that we do as a legislature to make sure that we're really cutting edge in a number of different ways, and it's a facility that we're really proud of that's taken care of. That number at the bottom, I looked yesterday, graph you'll see in a little bit. We're at about 455 employees currently working in the different divisions that I'll talk about.
Our mission is to prevent, investigate, and solve crimes in collaboration with our criminal justice partners. And really what that means, as the commissioner noted, while we do a lot of investigation, we also do a lot of work with a number of different partners across the state to work for ways to prevent crime before it happens through all of the different activities at the Bureau. Most importantly, the work that we're really doing at the BCA is we work to deliver exceptional law enforcement services for a safer Minnesota. We have partners and customers and stakeholders across all different types of pieces of the criminal justice puzzle. Our primary partner is Minnesota law enforcement, and we view that role as providing expertise, resources, or some sort of specialized services to our law enforcement partners so they can help keep their community safe wherever they may be in the state. Our core values are integrity, excellence, ingenuity, and partnerships. And what those mean to us is, I think integrity is easy to say, but I think, as you've seen probably over the last few years, the BCA has been in a number of very difficult situations across the state, in the middle of some things that we've been grappling with the state, and we expect every one of our employees to do the right thing, even when it's really difficult to do, and that's a value that we hold very dearly. Excellence in that all of you as a legislature and the citizens of the state really expect and demand that we are putting our best foot forward every day, and the work that we deliver to our partners is really of the highest quality so that you can count on that as a state. Ingenuity is really what you were talking about, whether it's reform, changing the way of doing business, evolving as an organization. Our laboratory was one of the first laboratories, the first laboratory in the United States to get a DNA hit when we first rolled out that technology, and that's what we ask our staff to do day in, day out, is to be looking 3 years, 5 years down the line to tell what is coming and how do we start pivoting so that we can be there to protect Minnesotans when those threats do emerge with us. And last but most important in many ways is the partnerships that we have. We talk to our agents, scientists, and professional staff that we work, everything we do is working with another organization, and those partnerships can take 20 years to develop, can be wrecked overnight. And so it's a core value so that we're always thinking about that, whether it's working with you as a legislature, whether it's working with our partners in the field, that they keep that in mind. I'll go through all these. I always love putting an org chart. It says, I put this up only to see all the different boxes that none of you can read in there to show that we really have a lot of different missions at the BCA that I'll talk about as we move on. We are located, as you noted, this is a very large state geographically, and so part of the reason we have field offices throughout the state of Minnesota is so that our partners, when they need assistance, when they're dealing with an emergency, they are not waiting for 8 hours for us to come up from the Twin Cities to go to Roseau, Minnesota, or Lake of the Woods. So currently we have offices in Rochester, Mankato, Marshall, Wilmer, Minnesota, St. Cloud, Alexandria, Moorhead, Minnesota, Grand Rapids area. It's in a small suburb of Grand Rapids. Duluth area, and then Roseau, Minnesota. We also have a regional office, which is that building pictured in the bottom right as you look at it, which is our regional laboratory in Bemidji, Minnesota, that does a lot of analysis for the northern half of the state that I'll discuss in a bit. We also have a number of agents at that location, and that's our largest field office. The remainder of those field offices are often in partnership with law enforcement. We look to areas to be with other sheriff's offices, other areas that spending your tax dollars wisely where we can get a good deal is usually how it works for us, so that we can partner with them and get cheap office space. But they're located there, usually homicide agents, violent crime that I'll discuss in a bit, narcotics, and then some predatory crimes agents in those locations. Our statutes that govern the Bureau, while we're there's a lot of duties sprinkled throughout the codes, the main one is 299C that governs the BCA. Our budget in FY18 is $59,900,000. With that, I'll also say we are regularly applying for, seeking out grant funds to do special projects, to supplement our work, from doing DNA backlog work to purchasing new state-of-the-art equipment in our organizations across the board, to anti-heroin grants to combat the illicit opioids we're experiencing across this state. Those funds can range anywhere from $5 to $15 million in additional dollars on top of that $60 million at any given time. It really varies on where we're at in that budget cycle. As you can see, it's fairly evenly split. You see that slice of pie called shared services. I just want to point out that the various divisions put money in. Those are things like our rent, different shared expenses that are being DCA-wide that just get dumped into a pot of money, so it's not really that large. That money goes to the different divisions. You'll notice that that slice of pie for Minjus that I'll talk about later is a little bit larger. That's because we're in the middle of some projects that we're working on. Most notably, the last budget cycle, you funded a new predatory offender replacement, a new predatory offender registration system for the state of Minnesota to replace an antiquated system. So that reflects some technology dollars that are in that budget. Our staffing is the same. It's fairly evenly split, with our investigations division having 133 staff. That's a mix of special agents, sworn law enforcement, and criminal intelligence analysts and support staff. Forensic science services, really the same, a mix of forensic scientists doing analysis and then forensic lab technicians. And then Minnesota Justice Information Systems. There are a number of, for your knowledge, of minute staff, about half in there. We always put them in the Minjus pie because we really treat them as part of the BCA. We want to have one team when we're working on IT projects internally, and we have a management control agreement that's necessary as part of our FBI security requirements to have management control over those minute staff in the BCA. Our investigations division is headed by Deputy Superintendent Jeff Hansen, who's here with me today. And I will go through these all in a little bit more detail, but our investigation section is divided up by our predatory crime section that I'll explain in more detail, our regional offices that house our homicide investigators, missing persons, special investigations or narcotics investigations, task force agents, and technical services. We also command the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force and have financial crimes agents working on those cases, the Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force, and we also have the Fusion Center within one of our sections. For us, violent crime or our homicide agents work on death investigations. They're often called in suspicious deaths across the state if it's a clear homicide and an agency wants assistance, or if it's a suspicious death and they'd like another set of eyes to look and see whether or not we have concerns about a death. We assist with cold case investigations. This is the unit that does officer-involved shooting investigations that I'm sure many of you have heard of and seen. We are at a point where we are doing the vast majority of officer-involved shooting investigations across the state of Minnesota. The number of investigations usually ranges in this state from 15 to 25 officer-involved shooting investigations in this state. And it's remained relatively stable with, I think we had 18 last year that we investigated. Conflict investigations are referred to as conflict of interest investigations. If a police officer or a public official or somebody of public prominence is accused of committing a crime, this is the group that often investigates those crimes. Remind me tomorrow. Critical incidents, crime scene processing that we'll talk from there. They provide some limited response. I'll explain our crime scene team in greater detail later. Narcotics investigations, we do have a number of agents across the state that do narcotics investigations. Our focus is much like you'd see the Drug Enforcement Administration. We work on mid to upper level drug dealing across the state, working with the 22, I believe, VSETs, the violent crime enforcement teams across Minnesota and local jurisdictions as they work to combat illicit narcotics trafficking in Minnesota. This group is usually working on upper level crimes, as I noted, and they're often dealing and methamphetamine in pounds of shipments is really what we're looking at.
Superintendent, we do have a question from Representative Councilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would constitute a mid-level narcotics operation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, really what we're looking at with this, and it, when you talk about the evolution, in the past it may have been a smaller quantity. I'll tell you, the regular amounts that we're seizing as methamphetamine, just for example, would be people dealing in pound quantities. So they might be dealing multiple pounds of methamphetamine. In the past year, we've seized amounts between 1 and 30 pounds of methamphetamine in shipments into the state of Minnesota. So that's where we're looking. This group focuses on criminal organized enterprises that are dealing these. We're not out doing hand-to-hand drug dealing enforcement in communities across Minnesota. We're really looking at apparatuses and organizations that are trafficking large amounts of methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine into the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
They perform undercover operations, as we noted, and then they participate in federal task forces. I do have a number of agents assigned to federal task forces across this state. The Drug Enforcement Administration is our greatest footprint. The reason that we have them assigned is really it's working in partnership then with our local and federal partners. to work in collaboration on these cases. It also provides an avenue for these agents to provide federal prosecution when appropriate in these situations. And I have four assigned to different task force, different teams in the Twin Cities area, from interdiction to major cases on the Drug Enforcement Administration to drug diversion. So we have one agent that's focusing primarily on opioid diversion from illegal fentanyl being trafficked into our state to any healthcare professional that's improperly providing prescriptions for people across Minnesota. The FBI Safe Streets Task Force is a task force comprised of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Police Departments and the FBI and the BCA. They focus on gangs, and what they focus on is large-scale gang investigations, trying to dismantle the operational heads of those organizations to keep our community safe in those two communities primarily. The Safe Trails Task Force focuses on drug dealing and gang activity in Indian Country in Minnesota. It's led by the FBI. We're a member of that task force as well, working on reducing violent crime and drug trafficking into our tribal nations across the state, primarily in northern Minnesota. And then we work with the United States Marshal Office on our predatory offender registration. They do have a federal mission with predatory offenders in our state, and we work with them to apprehend our non-compliant predatory offenders, or the work we do as well to get those predatory offenders compliant so they do not get arrested. It really depends on the scenario.
Commissioner, I'm wondering what quickly, what, how would you characterize the relationship between the BCA and our tribal law enforcement entities, and I suspect that that also involves perhaps a heightened level of federal law enforcement presence. Yeah. Just to give us a picture of what that looks like in the state.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair and members. We have really worked hard to have very good relationships with our tribal nations across Minnesota. As you know, there's 11 individually recognized tribes and reservations in the state of Minnesota. The relationship that we have really depends, as you know, like any different nation, any different police department. It varies depending on the organization that we're working with, but we have excellent relationships with them. Your comments about it varies in terms of federal makeup. There are two, Fond du Lac and, Boys Fort and Red Lake are two federal tribes that are closed reservations in Minnesota, so the state does not have jurisdiction in on those reservations, but we work very closely with our federal partners and those reservations as well. Red Lake is a great example. That Safe Trails Task Force I alluded to, we have agents that are deputized that work with the Red Lake Tribal PD, that work with the FBI up in that location, and have a very good working relationship in that area. There's also two tribes in White Earth and in Mille Lacs that have Assumption, or TLOA, it's called Tribal Law or Liaison something Act. TLOA is what we refer to it. What it allows for is concurrent jurisdiction with the federal government. Mm-hmm. So the tribe can make a decision whether or not they want something prosecuted both at a local level or under state laws or under federal jurisdiction. And so it does require some additional coordination, but we've worked that out with our federal partners and our tribal nations and really have a good process working now. One thing I do want to note in terms of the work we've done, the BCA currently is administering an anti-heroin grant from the federal government that is focused on opioid issues and related to trafficking with the nexus to Indian Country in Minnesota. So we have joint powers agreements in place with a number of the tribes around Minnesota to provide overtime and assistance to them as they work to investigate those crimes in their communities. And so that's just but one example of how we've worked to partner with those tribal nations.
Thank you. We also have a question from Representative Johnson.
Not so much a question as a statement. I know I've worked in my law enforcement career with the with a couple of different tribal nations, and the guys on their department are great. Generally, the administration of those departments, and they work together with the with everybody just fine. Usually, if there's an issue, it's above them.
Thank you. Please proceed, Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Our predatory crimes section is composed of our internet crimes against children. We command the ICAC task force for the state of Minnesota, which has approximately 100 affiliates. So we work with our agencies across Minnesota providing training, coordination, and assistance with overtime and technical assistance in examining computers, mobile devices, etc. And really this group is focused on the online exploitation of children and child pornography investigations.
We have a question for Representative Grossman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent, for being here today. We talk back and forth periodically, talking about the ICAC. What are you seeing? What do you guys see? Are you still seeing that continuous growth in child pornography and exploitation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we continue to see a growth. The number of ICAC tips we receive from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children continues to go up each year. It's I don't want to say it's leveled off. It's not as steep as it was at one time, but we increase the number of tips we receive every year. What has been most disturbing in, say, the last 5 years to our investigators is the age of the children that are being abused on video and taken pictures of and distributed on the internet continues to go down, meaning we're seeing infants, at times toddlers, that are being sexually abused by predators, and that's being videotaped, distributed on the internet. So that's part of the reason we treat this crime so seriously in our state, is that it's real victims, it's real people that are being abused, and they're re-victimized every time that image is shared and somebody downloads that across the internet. So we continue to see that. We're very dedicated to working on those. There are a number of technology complications that we faced over the last few years, from using encrypted messaging, from using different online vehicles to thwart our ability to detect some of these people. But we continue to work very diligently, and we still arrest a large number of people each and every year.
Thank you.
This group also has, and I'll jump down one, we have the Predatory Offender Registration System, so we have a staff that maintains and coordinates with all of our predatory offenders who are required to register across the state of Minnesota. We currently have about 18,500 registered predatory offenders in the state. There's been about 27,000 that have registered over the lifetime of the program. And as I noted, we're in the process of replacing the registration system right now to make it easier to use for Minnesota law enforcement, to refresh the database, to provide greater functionality, to ensure compliance of the individuals who are on registration, to provide greater access to our partners who access those systems. We also have agents that are working with our local law enforcement who do the bulk of the registration checkups with offenders across Minnesota. And we do have agents that, under our statutes, when a level three offender goes non-compliant, we're required to initiate an investigation as the BCA. And so we work closely with our law enforcement partners if a level three offender, meaning those most likely to reoffend, goes non-compliant, to track them down and either arrest them or get them back into compliance.
Superintendent, Representative Grossman has another question. Representative Grossman.
I don't know if everybody knows exactly what types of crimes would put them, convictions would put them on the predatory offender registry.
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grass, the primary ways to get on the registry are sex offenses. So there's a variety. They're contained within the statute. It is primarily sex crimes that gets you placed onto that. There are some others. That's why we call it predatory in Minnesota. Homicide, some of the other false imprisonment, kidnapping can make you register as well. That's why we call it predatory offender. But the bulk of them are sex offenders in our state.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to clarify, Superintendent, that that I think often the way the statute's set up, we don't need to get into a lot of detail, but that maybe the person is charged with one of those crimes and then convicted of something coming out of the same offense. But just to make sure, there are some situations where even if the person's charged with a sex crime, they may be convicted of something else, or charged with false imprisonment, nothing to do with sex, convicted of disorderly conduct, and they would still go on that predatory offender list, if that's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that is correct. In our state, you are required to register based on the charged offense if there is a conviction out of the same set of facts and circumstances, you are required to register. So exactly as you described is correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
The other last piece of this group is that we do human trafficking investigations across the state, as we noted, working with our partners throughout Minnesota. As I noted before, we have a human trafficking investigators task force at the BCA that's comprised of the Minneapolis, St. Paul Police Departments, the Anoka County Sheriff's Office, the BCA, a member of the Department of Homeland Security Investigations Unit focusing only on human trafficking investigations, and then we have an embedded Ramsey County prosecutor providing us prosecutorial guidance to that task force as we work, and they work throughout the state of Minnesota on large-scale human trafficking operations. Our special investigations unit, our special operations or technical services unit, they provide pen registers. These are often done in drug dealing, human trafficking cases. These are dialed digits in and out, so if we get a court order, we will monitor phone contact back and forth. That's what a pen register is. Wiretap investigations, we maintain a state wiretap room. And covert cameras for surveillance that we're working on, any electronic surveillance, cellular tracking, and crime scene response. I think it's important to know we do all this surveillance in support of only criminal investigations. We have to follow proper legal process in every one of these, and as I noted, we are following proper legal process because we respect the privacy interests of all the citizens in the state, and the evidence that we're gathering in those cases, we need to be able to use it in courts. So we have to gather it in a proper manner under the laws and regulations that we follow. We also, I'll talk about it a little bit later, but we have agents assigned to our crime scene team, and so that those agents come out of this unit. A criminal information and operations section, these are the criminal intelligence analysts and other professional staff that work in this section. This entails the Minnesota Fusion Center, our duty, our BCA operations center that's maintained 24/7, just like any other communication center for law enforcement across Minnesota. The BCA duty officer program, which as you can think of is kind of the 911 for law enforcement. They don't respond, but if they need a hazmat team, chemical assessment team, bomb squad, other resources, statewide resources, the notifications that need to go out go into this location, and then our duty officers make notifications to the proper authorities that need to know across the state. And that's all the way from there to if we were to have a nuclear disaster in Minnesota, that's the group that handles the notifications. We have reactive criminal intelligence analysts that are embedded with our investigative teams. They do a lot of the organization. They do a lot of the background work that we need to do on these cases, getting different records and organizing that. So they work as a very much embedded member of our investigative team. Missing Persons Clearinghouse is one person, but it's a clearinghouse, and she works with families and works in Minnesota for missing persons. If family members have questions, if they need assistance working with law enforcement, this is their point of contact to really help them navigate that system working on those cases across Minnesota. I'm sure all of you have heard about Amber Alert. All Amber Alerts are approved through the BCA. It's housed in this section for the state. Our Crime Alert program, we send about 250 crime alerts in the state each month, and that's sharing information primarily from law enforcement, and that can be shared with law enforcement if they have a picture of somebody who committed a crime. Two, it can be us sharing a missing person to the public as a whole, or we may be able to target somebody that we send information to gas stations, for example, or to hospitals when they're trying to share information. They can pick and target different businesses to share information readily across the state. That's done through an email system. And most recently, something you passed a couple years ago now is the Blue Alert program. When a police officer is seriously injured or killed in the line of duty, it primarily follows the same criteria as activating an Amber Alert to share information about subject or subjects that we are trying to find.
Superintendent, I'm going to, I think, powerfully role model for my committee members here and under the rule that there's no dumb question. So the Fusion Center, I'm guessing that's a database, but I actually don't know what that is.
Mr. Chair and members, it's an excellent question. It is the Minnesota Fusion Center. There are 78 fusion centers across the United States. They were created after 9/11 when we recognized that there was a lack of information sharing and that there was a lot of information that a lot of different organizations had on the hijackers that did that work, that the dots were not connected. And so they are a federally funded program, and their primary mission is we take an all-crimes, all-hazard approach in our fusion center. with a couple of different things that we do primarily. All suspicious activity, I shouldn't say that, suspicious activity reporting, that you see something, say something, we've all seen those campaigns, so suspected terrorist activity, that information is reported into that fusion center. If another state is investigating a crime, I'll give you just an example of this. Just in the last few weeks, we've been working on a couple of school threats with an individual that had a nexus to Minnesota. That individual had moved to another state. We then work closely with those other fusion centers that I can't talk about in different states as it's ongoing to help connect those dots to more quickly move when we need to do something to mitigate a threat as that. It also allows us to have in our building, we have a secure room where we're able to access classified information. So for you as citizens of Minnesota, when we have an attack like a Boston bombing, the federal authorities did not have a quick way to share information with us in a classified setting to share information that's relevant to our state. So we'll immediately be in conference calls, video conference calls, hearing from the authorities that are on the ground to share what they know about that terrorist attack as it occurs or shortly thereafter, so we can make a determination. Is there a nexus to Minnesota? Are there steps that we should be taking as a state to help protect our infrastructure, our citizens in Minnesota? So it's criminal intelligence analysts in that location. We have BCA analysts, but we also have a lot of partners from the Homeland Security Emergency Management at the state level to the Department of Homeland Security as an intelligence officer assigned to us in that location, to the FBI works with us out of that location, to the State Patrol, to the Dakota County Sheriff's Office. And so we really have, even non-traditional, HCMC, Hennepin County Medical Center has an individual that's assigned to us in that location as well. What they primarily do then is they take in information from different sources, they synthesize that information, and then they share relevant information with our law enforcement and public safety partners across Minnesota for trends, things that they should be looking for, information that we know of that might be relevant to their jobs every day. And those are done through informational bulletins and products that we distribute through our network for the Fusion Center across Minnesota. We also have a threat liaison program, a threat liaison officer program with that if, as you noted before, it's a very large state. If we have a refinery that catches on fire up in the Twin Ports, for example, or if we have a train derailment, for example, in northern Minnesota impacting a town, we have people that we work with from law enforcement, from fire services, that we can call directly and say, what are you seeing on the ground? Do we think that this is an accident? Do we think that there's more going on? What resources can we offer as a state to those jurisdictions across Minnesota?
Thank you. I do recall, as I'm sure most of us or all of us do here, the horrific days, 911, and I do remember a lot of very broad questions about why aren't we better at being able to connect the dots. And so it seems to me that the confidence of the public, you know, is strengthened by our ability to be smart about that and be intentional about that. And it also seems to me, and I think it was embedded in your comments and your description, that there's a and I'm guessing it's a healthy, but that there's a appropriate tension in terms of that and data privacy. So you talked about secured, you know, access, et cetera. So I imagine that there's a constant reflection about how you do that in a way that guarantees and protects our constitutional rights as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. It is a tension and something we discuss regularly. While we need to monitor criminal activity and potential criminal activity as it's occurring, we have a privacy policy in place that respects people's, in particular, First Amendment rights to protest, freedom of expression, and that we aren't out monitoring the public as a whole. We need a criminal nexus before this section engages in looking for those threats that would impact our state.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Next, moving into our Forensic Science Services Division, which is overseen by Deputy Superintendent Kathy Knutson, who's with me here as well today. We have three primary locations and two large locations that conduct forensic analysis across Minnesota. The one and our largest laboratory is at the BCA here in the east side of St. Paul. with an evidence intake and processing unit, biology, DNA, that kind of become the gold standard of forensic science in terms of what we're looking for. And this is one of those sections that, as we learn the value of biological evidence that grows continually every year, drug chemistry, which is one of our highest throughput laboratories, latent fingerprints is not to be forgotten. DNA is such a great tool, but latent fingerprints still provide us a lot of information in our investigations. Firearms and tool marks investigations, crime scene investigation. As I said before, we have a bit of a unique crime scene team. We work on violent crimes across Minnesota, assisting our partners with this as well, primarily homicides, death investigations, missing persons, and officer-involved shootings. Those teams are comprised of two scientists, usually a team leader that identifies and collects the evidence at the scene, and then a team member from our laboratory that does the same, working in conjunction with that team leader. And then we have agents that do the documentation of the crime scene. They take all the photographs, they take the video of the scene, and then they create diagrams after the fact back at the BCA. We like this approach because it really gives us a holistic examination of the crime scene team, or of the crime scene from our perspective, examining it from a forensic perspective, but then also putting on that investigative hat as we're looking at that scene. The digital and multimedia evidence in the last year, two sessions ago, you provided additional staffing for us in our digital multimedia evidence. That section grows exponentially every year. The volume and the amount of evidence that we examine, it really, when you talk about it, almost doubles the amount of data and information, and we're continually assessing. When you talk about evolution, inside of our BCA, when we first moved into this building only in 2003, our digital laboratory was really the size of a fairly small state office. We've now commandeered two large investigative rooms and that office, and have placed doors in between to accommodate just the exponential growth in digital evidence. When we first started doing this, it was primarily focused only on child pornography. That's what we did. Now we're seizing digital evidence in every single criminal investigation that we do, because every one of us has a smartphone that we carry with us, the thumb drives I put in here, the iPad that I'm using today. And so that group has to be really on the cutting edge all the time. With that, and one of the things that was implemented a number of years ago for you, from you as well, was requiring forensic laboratories to attain accreditation to ensure the quality of examinations within our processes at our forensic laboratories across Minnesota. I'm proud to say that that group this past July attained accreditation for our multimedia evidence, one of the few disciplines that we were not accredited in here in our laboratory, to assure all of you that we're adhering to the highest standards when we're doing our examinations in our laboratory. And they're housed within our, we have a really unique process, they're housed in our investigations division, but we are overseen by our quality assurance in our laboratory because we work so closely together within the BCA. Trace and chemical testing, these are traces thought of. It can be anything from examining glass at a crime scene to footprints that are left behind at a crime scene. We can often identify duct tape that was torn from a roll to another roll of duct tape, that it's all the kind of stuff kind of matching up and looking for physical characteristics within our crime scenes. Chemical testing is what often you think of as arson investigations. We look for different accelerants primarily when we see arson and fire debris, looking for things that may give us things to look at from there. Toxicology is primarily looking at alcohol and drugs in our blood and urine. The bulk of this work is done with our DWIs. We also do look at it, though, for other crimes such as sexual assaults and other types of crimes where we're looking at primarily, is there a drug or intoxicant in a victim system that would help us determine why a crime may have been committed. Our calibration laboratory, the BCA is required to provide the breath test machines, we call them DMT machines, breath test machines, and the training for all of Minnesota law enforcement. So our alcohol DWI enforcement across Minnesota, those machines are stationed strategically throughout our law enforcement agencies all across the state of Minnesota for easy access, and then we train all of the operators of those systems. When you talk about trends, I will tell you, when it comes to the toxicology and calibration laboratory, it really depends on what Minnesotans are ingesting at any given time as to which one of these are being used more heavily. The breath test machines only can sense alcohol, And so if we suspect that somebody's using other drugs or they are impaired only from drugs, that has to be done through a blood or urine test. And so that goes into our toxicology lab. There's also a number, DWI litigation is pretty rampant. It happens on a very regular basis. So depending on the state of the law at any given time, that will drive whether or not police officers are using breath test instruments more, or they're requesting blood or urine in that process. When you ask about how we've evolved when we do this, a couple years ago, because of a court ruling, police officers are required to get search warrants to get blood in DWI cases. What that drove for us is we wanted to be responsive to our law enforcement officers. We heard stories of police officers having to bring a detained person to a judge's house in the middle of the night, and well, they'd sit in the back seat of the squad car while the officer would get a search warrant signed. So we charged MinJIS, which is our Minnesota Justice Information Systems, with creating an e-search warrant, which the judges, police officers around the state have greatly loved. The police officer writes their search warrant electronically. They push a button. It goes to a judge. They can read that wherever they are on their iPad. They can either approve, reject that search warrant. Comes back electronically. It's saved a ton of time and effort across the state, and we're continuing to hone that for more specialty search warrants across Minnesota. So that's an example of how we try to be responsive to what people need in the field. In Bemidji, I won't go through all of them again, but we call it a targeted services laboratory. Some of the forensic science, we really work to be efficient continually within our organization, and so we place some of those high-throughput examinations, and we want to make sure that we're being the most efficient in our examinations. I'll give you an example of that. We moved our DNA instrumentation to do the actual DNA analysis from Bemidji down to St. Paul in the last year because as we bought new instrumentation, they are able to process more samples at the same time, and we found those instruments like to be very busy, working all the time, and we don't want any downtime for that. So we do serology, which is the identification of bodily fluids, identification of samples, and then the DNA is done in St. Paul. And so we're continually looking at, are we maximizing our efficiencies and effectiveness in our laboratories? A couple years ago, we opened up, in being responsive to our partners as well, an evidence intake facility at the St. Cloud Police Department. We had conversations with that police department that built a really great laboratory in their really state-of-the-art police facility, but because of the accreditation law that came into effect, they determined that they weren't going to move forward with that because of the expense and time and effort. So they came to us and said, would you have an interest in occupying that space? We wanted to have a better location in that area, and so they provide the space, we provide the personnel, and one day a week right now we intake evidence so that people from Alexandria, Minnesota don't have to drive down to St. Paul to submit their evidence. They can submit it at the St. Cloud Police Department. This spring we're looking to expand the drug testing in that location to better utilize that space so that they, again, will get those results more quickly. They have less farther to drive in that location, and so those are the kind of partnerships that we really look to develop across the state.
Superintendent, where do you get your talent? Where do you get these scientists? And is that an issue in terms of accessing, that kind of professional, preparation, technical preparation to do this work?
Mr. Chair, members, it's a really great question. I'm happy to report we get really excellent candidates as our scientists that are dedicated to the mission, that are extremely bright. What I will tell you, though, is the vast majority of them come in right out of college with a physical science degree. And so what that does mean for us is we have to invest very heavily in their training. Some of our training programs take up to 2 years before they're allowed to produce casework because we need to ensure that they're proficient, that we can count on their examinations, and they know what they're doing. We get really great candidates on the front end. We have to work really hard to keep good employees to make sure that we don't lose that 2 years of training that we put into them. We've also started a program that's forensic laboratory technicians that does some front-end processing for us, and that's done to drive efficiencies as well. For example, a gun used to come into the BCA, and that gun would have to go, if they wanted latent fingerprints, to our latent fingerprint laboratory, to our DNA laboratory for swabbing, and then our firearms laboratory. That front-end processing is now done by these technicians, so we can do whatever we can on the front end, and that gun goes straight to the laboratory, the swabs go to our DNA laboratory, so that we don't have to go in sequential order. We can do all those exams at once. That's become a really great program we found at hiring good people there that work into that program that then move into our forensic laboratory as scientists.
We have a question for Representative Grasso and then from Representative O'Neill. Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're talking about these, the processing and the technicians and all this. We had some bills that were vetoed last year by our former governor, and one of those bills contained four technicians that you requested. How has that impacted you, and is there going to be four going to be requested again? And if the four with the new year and with all the increase in what you're talking about, as far as the narcotics, as far as the technical stuff, the video, all of that such, are you going to be asking for six? Do you need more technicians to help make this, move this along to make sure that things get processed in a timely manner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grasso, I think as the commissioner noted, they're having ongoing budget discussions with the governor at this time. What I can tell you is that, those scientists were requested at that time last year based on the caseload that we have. We've been working on efficiencies, and one of the things we certainly will relay the needs of the organization based on what we're trying to accomplish for Minnesota and drive those turnaround times down to acceptable levels. But I want to tell you that our staff really works hard also to think outside of the box, and we've implemented a program called microcrystal testing that's really allowed us to, with drug testing in particular, to not be at a year turnaround time. We started a program with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office in that county to do a pilot program with microcrystal testing. We've implemented that in a good chunk of the state right now, and it's a different way of doing examination of drug cases in Minnesota. That efficiency, while we continue to see a lot of pressure on our laboratory because of the exponential increase every year of drug submissions, has allowed us to not be at a year turnaround time that we'd be at today. And so I give them a lot of credit, but we are having those ongoing discussions with the governor's office at this time.
Thank you.
One more question. I want to take you back to the ICAC just for a moment. Does our state child pornography statute, as it's written today, is it doing the job, or are there some deficiencies that can be improved upon from what you're seeing and as far as convictions, what kind of sentences are being handed down for those? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Grasso, I do leave those sentencing decisions to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Committee in terms of what they're doing. What I will tell you when it comes to child pornography, I think the statute has the right guide work. I am not seeing us lose cases that the statute is become an impediment for us in any way. I will tell you that we work really diligently, and we continue to educate both persons in our community and the judicial branch as well about the seriousness of child pornography, that the various studies that we've seen is the number of hands-on offenders for people that are downloading child pornography en masse are very concerning, and that we aren't doing this because somebody looks at a picture. We're doing this because somebody wants to harm a child and what that means for the safety in our communities. And so we're working really hard to continue to get that message out. I haven't seen an impediment with the actual statute, but I leave those sentencing decisions to all of you and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Well, members, we'll certainly have the opportunity to interact with the Sentencing Guidelines as well as with our community of prosecutors in the state to entertain these questions and others as well. Representative Russell, you good? Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Superintendent Evans. So back when I toured, must have been 2 years ago now, your digital lab had two men there, and it sounds like you've expanded. How many do you have now in that unit?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, we have 8 full-time examiners. We have 6 in the St. Paul office. We also looked and we've expanded those services for the same reason. Originally, we envisioned putting them all in St. Paul, but to be closer to our partners, we put 2 at our Bemidji Regional Facility as well. So they're up and operating now, producing really great work. We found really great employees doing that work, and we're really proud of them getting that accreditation because they worked really hard to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you and I worked really hard together on some sexual assault rape kit legislation. And at that time, you were doing about 1,000 per year, kits per year, and I know that there was some grant money that came through to help test some of these untested kits, and I'm just curious if you're still at about 1,000 per year of the rape kits that you can test, or have you upped that number, and were you able to hire some more people in the DNA lab, or, you know, how many folks are you up to there?
Yeah, the DNA, you know, how many we have? 25? 35. So, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm phoning a friend. Representative O'Neill, so 35 scientists that were working on there. The trends continue to go up. I was trying to pull up the actual number here in front of me because I did get it today. I will tell you as I locate that going through here, the number of rape kits we have seen continue to increase into our laboratory. There were about 3,500 kits that were taken, that were inventoried a couple years ago when that inventory was required. We've worked with agencies like Duluth that had a grant to drive their number of kits down and complete the testing on those kits. We also recently obtained with the Office of Justice Programs, with other partners such as MCAS and other advocacy groups, the Anoka County Sheriff's Office, a grant to process. We tiered those kits for the agencies that had the largest number of kits to the agencies that had the lowest number of kits. That tier one and two, which is about 60% of the kits, we have funding that we'll be able to test those kits. In that process with Duluth, we validated a new technique at the BCA for us called a directed DNA. And that bypasses the examination for semen under a microscope when we do that initial screening. What that does is it allows us to screen for Y STR's DNA. We're looking for male DNA. Mm-hmm. And when we find that, we will then be able to do that testing if we locate that male DNA. And that has greatly sped up our process. It's working really great for us in Minnesota, which has allowed us to test these kits more quickly to get answers out into our law enforcement partners, which will either potentially identify a guilty person or, just as importantly, exonerate the innocent in that process.
Just one last question. I apologize. This is a great interest, not just to me, but others in the room, so I know that this is really interesting to all of us.
Representative O'Neill, this is obviously a very current, pressing issue that's attracted a lot of attention in our public, so it's appropriate for us to spend the time that we spend querying each other on what's happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My last question will kind of help kind of tie it all up. And so the last question is, so, you know, I hear that you've probably increased it from 1,000. You've tested all 500 from Duluth. It's come down. So that brought the 3,500 down further. I'm guessing, and I'm not sure what the Category 1 and Category 2 are, but I'm assuming there's been a priority ranking of that 3,500, because some of them, as we look through, you know, the survey of all of them, some of them were closed cases or other reasons why they weren't tested. So what would be remaining of, say, the higher priority? I guess it was at 60% of the 3,500. Is that kind of where you're at?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes, that's correct. We tested the 500 from Duluth, so, you know, reduce that number. So I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it's a really good question in terms of the priority of those kids. What we've been talking about is there are a number of kits in that process, and that's part of the grant, is to really examine and to make sure, first off, that those kits are cleared to be tested under the law that you worked on and passed, and make sure that they are cleared for testing in that process. And then what we're telling them in this is, because they're sitting on shelves, we really want to learn from these kits. Mm-hmm. And some of the outstanding discussions we've had with our partners in advocacy and from all the different disciplines is really making a determination. What do we learn from these kits? Do they provide leads in other cases? Do they show us information that may connect them to a different community, as we've seen in other areas around the United States? And that's really what we're looking for in these, to provide answers in the specific case, but then see, do we learn anything additional from the data that we retrieve in looking at all these kits? To answer your original question, you were spot on with your numbers. It was 1,093 cases for CSC kits that we examined last year. In 2017, it was 1,114 in 2018 that came into our laboratory at the BCA for examination. So we continue to see a gradual uptick in that process. I will tell you, at the chiefs and sheriff's meetings I attend across Minnesota, as we talk about sexual assault investigation, this is a topic we talk about in terms of making sure that you're really turning in kits for examination that are going to provide answers in your investigations.
And Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment. So I think that, you know, as you were just discussing that, what's so important is to realize, at least nationwide, the studies that have been done is about 60% of the cases you have a serial rapist. So you have someone that's done this before. And I had asked Superintendent Evans offline before we started, you know, are you seeing that in these kits that you're testing? Are you seeing the serial rapist? Because obviously we want, you know, high priority for me anyway, I think for all of us in the room, is get the serial rapist off the streets. You know, you don't want to get the lower priority are the ones that it's not clear what was actually happening, you know, was it consent, was it not. But the serial rapists that are predators, we want them off the streets. And so that was really my focus of the whole thing, is we want to make sure that the information coming out is that we can focus on the high priority predators. So thank you. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you for your leadership on that issue in recent years here in the state. Superintendent, we have about 50 minutes left, so I just want to not rush in, but I just want to make sure you're able to most get out what you really want to get out today. And of course, we will be back with you in the coming weeks as well, but just letting you know. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I'll continue. I saw the clock myself. What I want to make sure that I do highlight for our laboratory, though, is that while we do all the testing in the laboratory, we also participate in a lot of national committees. We really have a lot of people that are engaged on the national level to ensure we really are cutting edge as a state, that we are adhering to the highest quality standards, and that we're moving the sciences forward each and every day. The other thing to be cognizant of in such a large state is your scientists are spending a lot of time on the road, driving all over this state, sitting in hallways to testify across Minnesota to the work that they've done, and that is a big portion of what they do as well. We are accredited, as I noted. It's really important for us. One slide that I do want to see, and part of the accreditation we take very seriously because we want those high-quality standards. This is a drug trends thing that you see. The numbers, as you can see for biology, is on the left-hand side as you look at the screen. That stent trends up steadily for all the cases that we see. In addition, drugs, which has really grown exponentially for us, the number of assignments in the last 5 years has really doubled for us. And that's what has created that pressure. Representative Grossel's question earlier, it has placed a strain on this laboratory. We have received some additional staff, and we've worked very critically to very diligently to create those efficiencies to keep up with that volume. Toxicology as well has increased from there.
Superintendent Representative Johnson has a question.
Mr. Chair, Superintendent Evans, I've just, since you're talking about the drug trends, as a former drug narcotics officer, have we seen any increase or decrease in the heroin or fentanyl cases that's been going on? And I know I've been hearing on the streets from the guys I know that meth is just skyrocketing. You know, if you could fill us in on a little bit of that and any other emerging drugs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I would agree with exactly what you said. Methamphetamine is skyrocketing in terms of the number of seizures that we've seen across Minnesota. We are continuing to see increased numbers of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs in particular in our drugs. And what is concerning to us, because it is such a deadly opioid if ingested at the wrong amounts, that we're seeing it not just in heroin. We're seeing it in methamphetamine. We're seeing it in cocaine. We're seeing other drugs laced with fentanyl, which is what is very concerning, because that is the drug, opioids, that we see killing our citizens at a really concerning rate in terms of what it is. The volume of opioids compared to methamphetamine, it's much less. We've seen a slight uptick in some cocaine that's coming in to the state as well, but opioids, because they're so dangerous in terms of what it means to the user, and then methamphetamine, we've seen at really significant rates, both in our laboratory and our drug investigations.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Minnesota Justice
Information. I'm sorry, I apologize. Representative Johnson, you had a follow-up.
I just saying that what really concerns me is the increase in the fentanyl and carfentanyls. But as you said, that is what's killing our people and our citizens. We got to come up with, not only at the state, but at the federal level to stop this.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Is Superintendent, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Minnesota Justice Information Services is the state's gateway to criminal justice information. So many of the different systems and that may or may not be connected are accessed from our law enforcement and other criminal justice users through the BCA. We have more than 50 computer applications. About 30 of them are public-facing or facing to our partners that access those systems, with the rest of them background in our side, connecting various systems based on the what we're trying to connect, the statutes, rules, etc. Our goal is always to deliver accurate, timely, and complete information to our criminal justice partners for better decision making. That's our goal when it comes to information for our criminal justice partners, is we want them to make informed decisions. We want to do that quickly and in a way that it may be a background check. We want to ensure that information is accurate so that person can get the job that they want to get going forward. It can be for a police officer on the street who is trying to identify somebody, if it's the person that should be taken into custody to do that. But more importantly, if it's not the right person, they can have that accurate information to let that citizen go on their way. Some examples of those different databases and data that we have at the BCA is the new criminal history system. I'm really proud to report that money that you appropriated for this system a number of years ago, we rolled that new criminal history system out for the state of Minnesota this March. And as far as May, and this is a major upgrade and a major new system for the state, we partnered with Boeing, like Flying Planes Boeing. They were our partner in doing this, and we had really had a really great partnership with them, a blend of our staff and then them building kind of pieces of it going in. That system has been rolled out with really a great improvement and many steps forward in our criminal history system. For a couple of the former law enforcement in here, we always promise you'd be able to read a criminal history report for the first time in your career, and I'm proud to report people can read criminal histories for the first time in their career with this new system. We've made advances in that to help with things like even as small as making sure we have the right person. We now take, there's booking photographs associated with that. We show the first few booking photographs right in the criminal history so we can have a visual identification if it's the person that's supposed to be on that criminal history that are verified with fingerprints. And so that system, we continue to make enhancement as was part of our release plan to that program, but it's really rolled out with very minor and expected. Any issues we've had are expected in any rollout with this system, and law enforcement has really appreciated this coming online. Predatory offenders, as we noted, law enforcement incident data that we have, driver and vehicle data. We provide the gateway for Minnesota law enforcement to access driver and vehicles information through that. That was done a number of years ago when some of you examined some of the issues of law enforcement inappropriately accessing. This brings it under our purview to make sure that we have an appropriate audit trail, that we're ensuring appropriate use in that process. All the fingerprints are housed on the APHIS system. That's a system that houses all of the fingerprints for the state of Minnesota. That's a system we're continuing to work on right now. It's nearing the end of its life span in that, so we're working with our vendor currently to provide some enhancements in this year, and we'll be working to figure out ways to make that system work for the state of Minnesota ongoing. Wanted and missing persons, order for protections are in that system. There's a system that was rolled out a few years ago for order for protections being electronic so that you can make notification through that system. We're in the process. Last session you rolled out, or last budget cycle, you rolled out a harassment restraining order funding to the courts to do something similar for what we have for those other orders. We are in the process of working with the courts right now to implement that so law enforcement can work on the notification electronically, that it's not all done paper. Prison, jail, detention information, domestic abuse, often referred to as DANCO orders, are in this our systems. Arrest booking photos, stolen property, charging data that's in there. We have e-charging. All of our, the bulk of our charging in Minnesota is done through e-charging. We're working right now with a fellow state agency to provide a refresh of that system that's at the point where it needs it to make sure that we're charging everybody electronically. That creates efficiencies in our systems so that we're not shuffling paper back and forth. Other state criminal history, it's the gateway to NLITS, which is our how we gather information from other states electronically from one point. It's done through there. So probation and supervision information is accessed through our systems from there. criminal history background checks. We do close to 500,000 background checks a year, both through name and fingerprint-based background checks. Every year, as more background checks are requested through this body, that number continues to increase. And part of what I talked about with that AFIS system, we're looking at ways to help us internally even speed that process so that we can have the system working more efficiently in the background on the electronic portion of it from there. We do fingerprinting in our office for background checks, information security. And I think you've heard both in this committee and other committees you serve on how important cyber security is to our state. It's something we're continually concerned about. It's something we're continually examining, and we're looking at ways to better protect and backstop the information that's highly sensitive information within our state and is utmost importance. That threat to all of us continues to grow every single year as our adversaries become more sophisticated, both domestically and internationally, trying to access our system. So it's something that's a regular concern to us at the BCA. We also produce all the statewide crime statistics. It's called the Minnesota Crime Book. It's online if any of you'd like to see it. To look at our trends throughout the state of Minnesota, we collect all that crime information, and then we ship it to the FBI. This year, we went online statewide. There's a new FBI use of force reporting tool that the FBI rolled out January 1st of this year. We had developed a tool so that Minnesota could report that information to the BCA. That came online in July of this year for us. We were ahead of the FBI in rolling out their system and what that's going to capture. We've always been requiring Minnesota law enforcement, I shouldn't say always, but since 1978, required Minnesota law enforcement to report the discharge of firearms. So if they discharge a firearm and shoot somebody, we had that information. What we didn't have is serious uses of force that result in great bodily harm or death, and now we have a tool so Minnesota can report that information, so we collectively as a community are able to look at that information and make decisions in our communities. We also deal with a significant number, being a state agency, of data practices requests. We keep some people very full-time fulfilling those requests for information that the BCA holds, and we take that very seriously, trying to be timely in those responses. The last, and being cognizant of time here, is the BCA is required by statute to provide training for the state of Minnesota. It also houses our auditors who go out and audit the access to criminal justice systems in Minnesota, so we access appropriate use, make sure there's systems in place to protect that data, that the right people are accessing it, etc. But last year we provided approximately 200 training courses and trained over 8,000 students in our training programs, really across the entire state of Minnesota. And as it says here, we audit those law enforcement agencies every 3 years. In terms of evolution, we used to have to visit every one of those agencies in person. Now we're able to spot check and do it that way because we can do it from our auditor's desk. They can access those systems remotely and ensure that the right things are done there, which allows us to get to more agencies in a timely fashion across Minnesota. So we always look for those efficiencies. And with that, I would open it to any questions you may have about the BCA.
Thank you, Superintendent. We do have at least one question. I do want to make a very quick observation. You and I visited recently, and one of the themes that you emphasized in our visit was the importance to public safety of thinking about time and shortening the time in which needed information is available. And it seems to me that the BCA has structured itself in such a way to consistently move. You've used the word efficiency repeatedly. Obviously, you're deploying new technology, which I think is helping with that. It may seem like, it seems to me that could be a sort of like, you know, obvious observation, but it seems to me to be a very critical observation in the dispensing of justice generally, that having too much time go by works against us. And I suspect Representative O'Neill that has a lot to say with, you know, some of the questions you posed earlier.
Mr. Chair and members, I would agree with, you know, your sentiments. We certainly work every day with the resources that we're given to conduct all of our analysis and as quickly as we can while ensuring the accuracy and the quality of our examinations. The same goes with our investigations. And the discussion, I agree that we've charged our agents and scientists, in particular in certain cases of extreme public concern, such as officer-involved shootings, to trying to complete those investigations in a timely manner so that the public can learn the details of those investigations. We've also worked very carefully with some of the prosecutors across the state to ensure those files are redacted in a very timely manner, often as decisions are being made so that the public can access that information when those decisions are announced publicly. And so we recognize the public's interest in some of those cases. We do work as diligently as we can without compromising the integrity of the investigation. And sometimes those investigations are going to take us additional time because we need to make sure that they're done thoroughly, completely, accurately, without bias, independently. But we have really done that. And just as an example, there are some challenges for us in terms of technology. We discussed body cams, for example, with police officers needing to review sometimes upward of 300 body cams in an officer-involved shooting at a scene. We've devised methodology where we have up to 50 agents across the state reviewing those body cams, dividing them up just for that reason so that we can ensure we continue to move those cases expeditiously through the system for to ensure the public gets to learn what they want to know about these cases.
Superintendent, we have time for one more question and observation, and that will come from Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Evans, you started to answer my question, which is on officer-involved shootings. You mentioned you're working hard to improve the timeliness of some of those investigations. I'm curious, you mentioned now that you do the majority of the state's officer-involved shooting investigations. What other steps have you taken recently, or do you plan to take to continue to build public trust in those investigations and continue to improve the timeliness?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's an excellent question and one we've been working on for a number of years now in terms of taking on especially St. Paul and Minneapolis and examining them. I am a member of the Association of State Criminal Investigative Agencies. It's the BCAs of the United States, state police, different names across the country. We have a use of force investigations committee, and these are issues we regularly talk about in terms of disclosure of information, how we do that, what we do to investigate, proper protocols, all those different things. I also sit on the IACP and International Association of Chiefs of Police, Police Investigative Operations Committee. This is a topic we discussed there as well about that. We've implemented a number of pieces in terms of writing a policy to provide guidance for our agents in the field to have very specific protocols. So it's done the same way whether you're in the city of Minneapolis or you're in the city of Baudette experiencing an officer-involved shooting from there. We have regular ongoing discussions with our partners about some of the issues related. Body cams are new to law enforcement, relatively speaking, and so we're talking about how we handle that in terms of evidence, what it means for the community in viewing some of this in regards to release of that information in regards to the law that you've passed governing body cam information from there. We have had those discussions when you talk about building trust, and as the chair alluded to, we want to share that information quickly and transparently. That's why we put all of our reports online in a manner that people can view them through those protocols, through those public websites, usually with the county attorney's office from there, so that they can review those. Some of the other things that we have worked on in terms of building trust, we participate with the FBI in a use of force forum. We've been in a number of communities across Minnesota to describe police use of force, what it means, but more importantly, what the investigative process is, what the BCA does when we come in to do one of these investigations, what the FBI and the Department of Justice's role might be in a use of force incident in any community. And so these are, what I can tell you is they're vigorous ongoing discussions about our process to ensure we're doing everything properly in that process. And I'll tell you, I have some really experienced, dedicated men and women who do these investigations who want to ensure that the public has trust in those investigations, that they do them independently without bias, without somebody influencing the outcome of any of their investigations, and they take that very seriously. And so I would say that we will continue to always examine not just our officer-involved shooting processes, but everything we do at the BCA to make sure that we're providing the best services possible, both to our partners across Minnesota and all the citizens of the state.
Okay. Superintendent, there are some other questions, but I'm afraid I'm going to apologize to my colleagues. We just simply don't have the time at this point, but I do look forward to having you and your staff return at some point, and we can further continue to have this conversation. I do want to thank your colleagues for being with us here today. And when I come back, when you come back, I'll ask you the question I wanted to ask you, which is, what do you most like about your job? But I'll leave that hanging for now. Thank you so much for being with us here.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Members, this committee stands adjourned.